I'm going to call the House Committee on Public Safety to order and call the roll, please, Laura.
Woodard.
Here.
Mullery.
Here.
Gothier.
Here.
Grunhagen.
Here.
Hilty.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Kelly. Kiefer.
Here.
Kreisel.
Here.
Leidiger.
Here.
McDonald.
Here.
Moran.
Here.
Nornis.
Here.
Slocum. Smith.
Here.
I understand Representative McDonald has looked through the minutes and would like to move to approve the minutes from the previous meeting. Is that correct?
I have, Chairman. I make a motion to approve the minutes.
Okay. Any discussion? Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Nay? Okay. The minutes are approved. So this morning you'll see that our agenda has changed a little bit, and we're going to start with the Department of Corrections this morning with the Department of Corrections overview. So I'm going to ask Commissioner Chris Bray to join us, please. Thank you for joining us, Commissioner Bray. We look forward to your overview.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Chris Bray. I'm the acting commissioner right now. I'm the deputy commissioner of the Community Service Division. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present today. We thought what we'd do is just give you a brief overview of our department, so it'll be pretty basic information. Normally, we do this presentation in a little different order. Normally, we start with the facilities, because that's where the offenders start, and then we talk about the Community Service Division, and then we talk about our Operations Support Division. With your okay, I would like to reverse the order a little bit and leave to go attend a funeral. So I'll give you a brief overview, talk about the Community Service Division, then Deputy Commissioner David Christ will talk about facilities, and Assistant Commissioner Lisa Ograski will talk about our Operations Support Unit.
Okay, sounds good.
Public safety is a core function of government. The Department of Corrections contributes to a safer Minnesota by focusing on public safety, and we do that by locking up the state's most serious offenders, by providing probation and parole supervision to offenders in the community, by providing opportunities to offenders for positive change, and by restoring justice for victims. To give you the big picture, I just wanted you to see that Minnesota is committed to serving offenders at the local level when possible. And so we reserve state prison beds for the most serious chronic offenders. And you can see from this graph that we are 49th lowest per capita in terms of incarceration. And what this really means is if you look at states with a comparable population, we're 49th lowest. The only state that locks up fewer offenders is the state of Maine. There's a 2008 Pew report. It's called 1 in 100 Behind Bars in America, and it recommends greater use of community supervision for lower risk offenders, and I believe that's the model that Minnesota uses. Now, just to give you an overview of the numbers very quickly, you can see the number of employees that we have in the Department of Corrections, our total budget for the biennium. We have 9,650 adult offenders. About 6.5% of those are female. In 1 year, we served 16,539 offenders from intake through release. We have 10 facilities, 2 adult, 2 juvenile. We maintain 6 million square feet of building space. We supervise, the Department of Corrections supervises over 20,000 offenders in the community. We have 14 district field offices scattered all over the state. Here's a very big picture of our budget. The institution division is about 70% of our budget. The Community Service Division is 25% of our budget, but it's important to note that of that 25%, 65% is pass-through money. And then our Operations Support Division is 5% of our budget. Now, that's the big picture, and I'd like to just switch gears and talk about the Community Service Division for a few minutes. But before I talk about the specifics of what we do in the division, I think it's important to be aware that we provide a variety of court-ordered services in conjunction with the state's other two community corrections delivery systems. So we operate out of a three delivery system model. What that means is that the Department of Corrections Field Services supervises in 28 counties adult felons, misdemeanors, and juveniles. In 55 counties, we supervise adult felons. The 28 that I mentioned, plus 27 other counties, we provide intensive supervised release in 75 counties, and we supervise challenge incarceration releases in 82 counties. So that's one part of the three-part delivery system. The Community Correction Act counties operate in 32 counties and 17 jurisdictions. In those counties, those Community Correction Act departments supervise all the adult felon, misdemeanor, and juvenile offenders. And they receive a subsidy from the Department of Corrections that contributes toward their budget. And then finally, the county probation officers counties operate under county judges. They provide supervision to juvenile and adult misdemeanors in 27 counties. DOC provides the supervision to those felons. Each county probation officer county receives up to 50% reimbursement for probation agents' salaries, and that passes through the Community Service Division. Currently, those, I'll just say for brevity, CPO counties receive up to about 36% reimbursement. That reimbursement has decreased a little bit over the years. So together, these three entities supervise 138,000 offenders in the community. Want to provide you once more with some statewide numbers. I talked about the 138,000. To break that out a little bit more, 132,000 are on probation. In other words, they've been court-ordered to probation. They have not been sentenced to prison. 5,400 have been sentenced to prison, have done their prison time, and have left prison and are being supervised in the community. And just keep in mind throughout this that when offenders are sentenced, they serve two-thirds of their time in prison and one-third of their time under supervision in the community. And again, Minnesota has a high number of offenders on probation in the community relative to some other states, but that allows us to use our prison beds for the most serious offenders, and so it is probably a more efficient use of our resources. Now, I'll just talk briefly about the people on probation. Those are the ones that haven't been sentenced to prison. Again, there's a total of 132,000 living throughout the state. You can see the breakout, 76% male, 24% female. You can see the breakout between juvenile and adult. Of those 132,000, the Department of Corrections supervises 18,000. And those are probation officers, and then you can see the breakout of offenses. Before I leave the topic of probationers, I just wanted you to see the recidivism rate. This is looking 3 years out, offenders who have been on probation and been discharged. And you can see that the 85% do not commit another felony offense 3 years after they've been discharged. That's a statewide number. That isn't a number just about Department of Corrections offenders. Now I'd like to turn to the Community Service Division specifically. I'll just start by talking about our reentry unit. Again, keep in mind, offenders spend two-thirds of their time in prison and one-third of their time in the community under supervision. The reentry unit is a very small unit, but I'm going to highlight it because their job is to help the Department of Corrections and really community corrections statewide to sharpen our focus so that everything we do is about successful reentry. And we're doing that not to be soft on crime, but to be smart on crime. If we can reduce recidivism, we can enhance public safety.
Commissioner, if I could ask you a question. How many of the people in prison come out off probation? I mean, is there still a sentence where they choose to stay in longer and then come out free of probation? And what would that percentage be? And does that is the recidivism rate higher for those people that that don't go on probation?
Mr. Chair, members, there are offenders that stay in prison through expiration for a variety of different reasons. I don't know that number offhand. The percentage offhand. I'd have to get back to you on that. In terms of recidivism for that group, we don't collect that information, but we do collect recidivism information on the offenders that come out of prison and do one-third of their time under supervision. And we know that those offenders, and again, this is statewide, their recidivism rate is about 36%. Commit new offenses, about 64, do not, and that's felony offenses, and it's 3 years after they've been released from prison.
Thank you, Commissioner. And then are there a lot of them that committed offenses how do you calculate the recidivism? In other words, if somebody goes, there's a lot of prisoners that violate a number of times, but their probationers don't send them back to prison. So is that kind of a misleading figure about the recidivism rate? I mean, are there a lot of offenders that commit crimes, but they're not counted in the recidivism rate because the probationers don't send them back to prison?
Well, if you're talking about probationers, they haven't gone to prison yet. And the way we calculate that recidivism rate is we look 1, 2, and 3 years out after they've been discharged from probation, and we look at the felony offenses only. So we don't look at misdemeanor offenses. When talking about the offenders that are released from prison into the community on supervision, same thing. We look at 3 years after they've been discharged, did they commit new felony offenses? So we're not talking about, in those numbers, we don't talk about technical violations, nor do we count misdemeanor violations or new offenses.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, I just want to finish talking about reentry because we did a pilot project, and through that pilot project, we learned that we could reduce reoffending by 40% to 56%. That was a pretty successful project. What we're doing right now, though, is looking at how we can really expand that statewide. So how do we take that out of the pilot phase? We have technical assistance from the National Institute of Corrections, and we have also received federal grants through the Second Chance Act. So I just want to highlight reentry as one of the things we're really focusing on. I'll move on now and talk about field services. That's also a part of our division, but what I want you to look at are the challenges we face in that division, and there are really two. One is higher caseloads. The average caseload for traditional supervision is about 131 right now. The other challenge is housing, and particularly finding housing for level 2 and 3 sex offenders. You can see that our field services unit not only oversees supervision in the community, but oversees the Interstate Compact, the Sentencing to Service Program, the Institution and Community Work Program. Our Grants and Subsidy Unit administers and monitors 360 grants, subsidies, and contracts. And again, I'll just remind you that that's 65% of the community services budget. Our Inspection and Enforcement Unit licenses and inspects 237 adult and juvenile correctional facilities. That includes halfway houses. It includes all the jails, and it includes out-of-state placements where Minnesota delinquents are placed. And then finally, our Community Notification and Risk Assessment Unit assigns risk levels for the purposes of community notification. You can see the number of predatory offenders with a risk level. We also assist law enforcement with community notification meetings and education meetings, and we maintain the Department of Corrections Level 3 website. We conducted 800 sex offender risk assessments and civil commit reviews last year. Want to talk very briefly about supervised release and intensive supervised release, just because I mentioned caseloads. Supervised release is for offenders who do two-thirds of their time in prison and then are released to do the final one-third in the community. The most intense level of supervised release supervision that we provide is intensive supervised release. Those are caseloads of 30 per two agents by statute. They have the highest risk predatory offenders, including all level two and three offenders, and we use a broad range of tools to keep close track of what those offenders are doing. And those tools include electronic monitoring, house arrest, 24/7 random visits, 24/7 random UAs. The number that you see, the 1,200 total offenders, is a statewide number. The Department of Corrections supervises at any given time about 364, excuse me, offenders on intensive supervised release. One of the most important tools that we use in supervision, the DOC, and I would say almost all of the counties statewide, is the essentials of research-based practices in corrections. And I've just highlighted very briefly five of those essentials for you to see. The bottom line is we use a validated, reliable risk assessment to help guide us in terms of the level of supervision that we provide to offenders. And so we know from the research we're best off targeting our resources toward the highest risk offenders and targeting our interventions to address those behaviors that lead to the criminal behavior. And then finally, I'd like to just end my portion in talking about community services by giving you an example of a program that we use where we're using our offender resources to benefit the community. It's the house building program, Institution Community Work Crews. We call it ICWIC for short. Started in 1998 with a $700,000 revolving fund to build affordable housing for low-income families. And then the fund is replenished when the homes sell. The offenders that are on those crews are a select group of minimum security inmates who are within the last 24 months of their incarceration. Because the housing market has dropped, we've looked to other places to use those work crews. And one of the more recent projects and really successful project, I think, is one we completed in Duluth, where we provided housing for vets and their families, as well as office space for the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans. We were just one piece of kind of a complex puzzle to put that together. Our piece was providing inmates for labor, but just note the before and after pictures of what the place looked like before we started and what it looked like after. And this doesn't even tell the story of what the inside of the place looked like before and what it looked like after. So with that, I'll conclude my portion of the presentation, but I have to ask, Mr. Chair, my intention was to leave for a funeral. I do have someone else here, Ron Solhide, from the Community Service Division, who's available to answer questions. So we can either do that now for my part, or Mr. Chris can talk about the facilities, and then Mr. Solhide will be available for questions on the Community Service Division. I would leave that to you.
Whatever worked for you, Commissioner, fine with us, however you want to proceed. But first of all, I had a question from Representative Leidiger.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to understand the scope of the numbers right from the beginning there. Are these numbers just the state police and county? Does it also include city, township, well, not townships, but certainly the cities and in the incarceration numbers there as well? Could you just speak to that, please?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Representative, could you tell me which slide you're looking at?
Oh.
Is it the one about comparison to other states?
Yes, the first two. You know, it says a population 5,200,000, and then we've the prison population 9,400, for instance. That's state. Those are state numbers, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, the population is the population of Minnesota in 2006. However, this was updated in 2009, and the numbers are relatively the same. So that's the entire population for the state. The 9,468 was the prison population at that time, so that does not include jail numbers or workhouse numbers, just prisons.
Just the prison.
Correct.
Can I just
one more thing. Then on page 8, those numbers, the felony, the gross misdemeanors, the adult total, that includes data from the cities as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no. That data is the number of offenders on probation throughout the whole state of Minnesota. And so to be on probation, a judge, you have to go through the court system, and the judge orders that person on probation. So these are looking at just the numbers of people on probation statewide, and then breaks out, you know, the number who commit felony, gross, misdemeanor, et cetera.
Okay. Thank you.
We've got Representative Smith next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Madam Commissioner, of the 9,600 or so in prison and the 138,000 offenders supervised, can you tell me the number of those that are either non-citizens and or here illegally?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, I can't. I think we have that number. I'll. Do you want to jump in?
And Commissioner, did you want to get going, or?
Well, as long as we're doing questions, I'm happy to wait. I should probably leave at 10 to 11 too.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith. I think we have that number back at the office that we provide to the feds every year. So we'll get that for you and get back to you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On slide 11, you talk about predatory offenders and you have risk levels. I'm just wondering if you could define the risk levels and also let us know who is on the public notification then. Is there a difference on the levels of what's public? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have a process that's in statute that the DOC is responsible for, and that's to assign risk levels to predatory offenders who are in prison. So now we're talking about only the prison population, not people on probation who haven't gotten into prison. So predatory offenders, when they're within roughly 90 days, but it varies, of being released, we conduct a pretty detailed, rigorous process to figure out their risk to reoffend. And that's in its most basic form. So we use interviews, tools, we have psychologists involved, we use history from going way back. We have a lot of information, and we assign them a level 1, 2, or 3. A level 1 offender is least likely to commit a new sex offense. A level 3 offender is much more likely to commit a new sex offense. And so that number 6,000 is all the 1, 2s, and 3s. The website that we maintain that's public is just level 3 offenders, and so anyone can look on that website and get an idea of where level 3s are in their neighborhood. We don't provide addresses, I don't believe, but we provide a geographic area.
Representative Kiefer?
Can you give us an idea of a percentage of 1 and 2 that statistically in the past have maybe violated your code and has become a problem?
Reoffender.
Yeah. Thank you.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I understand the question. I am going to have to go back and look if we have a breakout of reoffending. I believe we do according to level, and I will look, and if we do, I'll provide it to you. If we don't, I'll let you know that we don't have that.
Okay. And Representative Grudhagen, sorry I missed you in the order there.
That's okay. Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, a question I have, just to your comparison chart, I appreciate that. It helps me as a layperson understand the information that we're dealing with. But my question would be, I'd like to see a comparison of the per diem cost in these different states. I like the list that you have there, although I'd appreciate including North and South Dakota. Do you know right offhand what Minnesota's per diem cost is for the inmates?
Mr. Chair, Representative, David will correct me if I'm wrong. I believe it's about $83 in some sense, but please jump in.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, it's $83.95 last year.
Plus tax, right? No. Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up. Is it possible to get that data for those states listed there, plus North and South Dakota in the future, so that we could have a comparison in that area?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we can certainly seek that information. I'll get you with the caveat right now that not all states compute their per diems in exactly the same way. So it's not necessarily apples to apples, but we can get you their numbers and show them next to ours.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner.
Go ahead.
And obviously when you bring the data, just like you did this data, you brought caveats of why we're located on the position that we are. I'd expect the same type of reasoning when you present that data, why we have the per diem we do, and the comparison, and any caveat that might be an exception or to understanding those numbers, okay? But I find that extremely valuable to be able to do that type of comparison. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Carger, could you jump in here and tell the committee here exactly, give them a layman's term of a per diem and some of the history and the comparisons and why it's such an elusive figure and maybe some background so that they understand what we've gone through the last few years? And that's a good question, Representative Grudhagen. It's one that we're going to discussed quite a bit during the committee process here. Thank you, Commissioner.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair and members, the per diem has come up over the years because it is a measuring stick for corrections, and I should point out that their average daily per diem is $83.95. However, the statute says they also have to calculate that per diem by including their part of the administration expenses, you know, part of the commissioner's salaries, part of the you know, support staff, and I think we estimate that at about 65%. And also, if you include capital costs, which is bonding, you know, you include those in the per diem, you come up with a per diem according to the performance report of $103.09. So I guess that's the discussion: is how does this committee want to define the per diem? And I think it'll be up to you. And I think, as the commissioner said, that it is a tough area because we've had this discussion before, and there used to be a corrections yearbook that came out that tried to define the per diem amongst other states. Well, what they found out was that some states were including things and others were excluding them. Like, some were including pension costs, other states were not including pension costs. Some had, like Louisiana, I think their health care was not in the correctional budget, it was by charity hospitals down there. So there is a difference, and it is hard to do. However, there is the federal government, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, they do try to come out with this where they try to compare apples to apples. And I think the last one they did was about 10 years ago, if I remember right, or maybe eight to 10 years ago. And at that time, Minnesota had a relatively high per diem compared to other states. But I have to give credit that since then, corrections has really dropped or lowered their per diem.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gruhagen.
You know, it just amazes me, just general point of information, having been on the school board for 16 years and asked for similar type comparisons, and having received the same information, it is so difficult to compare. It seems like in the private sector, those comparisons seems to be more readily available, and in government, it seems like it's so difficult to get apples for apples comparisons. Not that government's resistant to that type of analysis, but one might draw that conclusion after working with the process for a certain period of time. So to the degree that we can have a apples for apples comparison, with the caveat of reasons why we are where we are, I would sincerely appreciate that as a member of the committee and in terms of evaluating the finances that were or the tax dollars that we're spending. I think taxpayers would also appreciate that, because that type of information is readily understandable on a comparative basis for most citizens and lay people in our communities. Thank you.
Commissioner Christ, do you want to respond, or do we go to the next question? Or are you done here?
Yeah.
Okay.
If there's another question, I think we can move on.
Okay. Representative Gauthier, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I basically have two questions. Mr. Christ, when we assign levels of risk to predatory offenders, and I know you don't have the reoffending data, but is there a correlation between level 3 offenders seem to reoffend more than level 1s? Is that a fair assumption or not? That'd be my first question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the levels are assigned using different instruments of risk assessment that they, I believe, are actuarial in their nature. And so if somebody is given a level 3, the presumption is that he is more likely to reoffend than a level 1.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, my second question. When a level 3 offender is released into the community, the commissioner talked about checks and supervision and whatnot, who's responsible for that? Is it local authorities? Is it the Department of Corrections? Is it the county? Who's responsible for doing all those things?
Mr. Chair, Representative, law enforcement is responsible for keeping track of the offender's address in making sure that he's got the most accurate address on file with law enforcement. They do that. But the corrections personnel do the supervision of that individual's release from prison. Now, sometimes that supervision is conducted by DOC employees. Sometimes that supervision is conducted by county employees, depending on which of the three delivery systems have jurisdiction for that location.
Okay, if I can follow up, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair. I have one of those houses across the alley from my house. And one of my questions that we never seem to get answered is when we have community meetings and we're told, you know, for example, these people are not to leave the property or the house or not to have visitors and so on and so forth. And if it's the department supervising that, why are we not given a contact number? Because I usually end up calling 911 when I see a violation. So part of my question is if the county's responsible for supervising and doing the check, why aren't we given that number? If it's DOC in the state, why aren't we given that number to call? Because my neighbors are always complaining about we don't know who to call.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think any time you suspect that there might be criminal activity going on, your best option is to call 911. The supervising agents, while they do work all hours and try to surprise guys with these random checks, are not necessarily on each of them on a 24-hour call out. And so I can check further on what we can do to give you a number that will connect you right to the Department of Corrections. But again, if you think there's a crime being committed, 911 is your best bet.
Representative Gauthier?
Well, if part of their release is not to leave the property or leave the property with consent only, obviously as a neighbor I'm not going to know that. And so they're roaming up and down the alley smoking, I should be calling 911. Is that what you're telling me? Because it's a violation of their release?
Commissioner?
Or possible violation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I guess I can't go that far. Okay. Because I wouldn't know, and I'm not sure you would know either with respect to each individual what the parameters of their supervision is.
Okay. Part of the problem, if I may, Chair, is that my neighbors feel like they've been put on police duty. You know, we're supposed to be watching these guys, and yet we don't have the support to do that because we don't know who to talk to or what's a violation and what's not a violation. We're guessing all the time. So what end result is nobody calls, even if there is a supervision violation. Nobody calls because we don't know what we're supposed to be doing. So hopefully in those public meetings a better job could be done with that is basically what I'm asking for.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, certainly your point is well taken, and we'll look into that. And I think I'll also ask if somebody can follow up with you personally and have further discussion on that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, any more questions from members? If not, go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, members, the first slide we've got here is a map with the geographical distribution of the facilities that we've got in Minnesota. Excuse me. We've got 8 adult prisons and 2 juvenile facilities. 84% of the staff that work for the Department of Corrections work in the facilities. One of the challenges that we've got in facilities is idleness. Idleness in our facilities approaches 18% right now. 3 facilities, offender idleness is approaching 25%. And when offenders are idle, they find something to occupy their time, often with misconduct. And when that happens, then staff and offenders in the facility are less safe. So I'm going to talk more down the road here about jobs and assignments, but it's vitally important to us that we find things to keep offenders constructively occupied while they are incarcerated. We do have some successes, though. One important one being that we haven't had any escapes from any of our facilities at any custody level for quite a while, and I don't even recall a serious attempt in recent history. Our facilities are under five different custody levels. Oak Park Heights is our level 5 maximum security facility. That is the most secure facility that we've got in our system. Level 4 facilities include Rush City, St. Cloud, and Stillwater. Level 3 are at Lino Lakes, Moose Lake, and Faribault. We call those medium custody facilities. There's a level 2 minimum at Faribault outside the secure perimeter of that facility. And then we've got level 1 minimum security facilities at Stillwater, Red Wing, Lino Lakes, and the challenge incarceration programs at Willow River and Togo.
Commissioner, what goes on at St. Cloud? How is that used now? It used to be called a reformatory and then the prison.
Mr. Chairman, that's my next slide after Oak Park Heights.
May I beg
your indulgence, and I just want to talk a little bit about each of the facilities and what they do, and I'll address that question. Oak Park Heights opened in 1982. It houses 440 adult males. These are our most difficult to manage offenders. It's very seldom that an offender goes right from the courts or right from intake to Oak Park Heights. Most of the guys that wind up at Oak Park Heights get there because they've misbehaved in other prisons. Mm-hmm. It houses our administrative control unit, and it also houses our mental health units and our transitional care unit, which is a step down from hospital care. One notable thing about Oak Park Heights is that it's still a fairly unique facility around the world, and it's been studied by corrections agencies worldwide and across the United States for what that facility is able to do. To your question, Mr. Chair, St. Cloud houses 981 adult offenders. It opened in 1889. It's one of our oldest facilities. It's level 4 close custody, and it serves as the intake unit for the department. Whenever anyone is transported from the county jails to prison, a male offender, they go to St. Cloud and they undergo a set of assessments there for psychological problems, medical problems, chemical dependency, sex offender treatment needs, education needs. We look at how much time they've got to serve. We look at their age. We look at their criminal history. And based on that information, we calculate the custody classification score and decide which facility of our other facilities is the most appropriate place for them to serve their time. St. Cloud also has a program for very youthful offenders. So on occasion, an offender as young as age 14 is certified as an adult and sent to prison. They will serve their time at St. Cloud at least until they get to be about 21, 22 years old before we transfer them to another facility.
And Representative McDonald had a question.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, I hope I'm not the only one curious to know what you do at Oak Park that attracts attention nationwide and worldwide. Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, thanks for the question. Most facilities of the Oak Park Heights type across the country are referred to as supermax prisons. Most of those supermax prisons lock up offenders 20 to 23 hours a day and very seldom let them out of their cells, very seldom have any programming for those offenders, very seldom have any work opportunities for those offenders. Oak Park Heights is kind of the opposite of that. We've found a way to operate a facility that rivals Supermax security any place in the country, but has offenders out of their cells constructively programmed for the majority of their workday. So except for counts in the sleeping hours, most of the guys at Oak Park Heights, if they're not on a disciplinary segregation kind of status, they're going to be out of their cells. They're going to be working in industry jobs. We operate the department's canteen for all of the other facilities. That's the store that inmates order from to get toiletries and other items. So they operate the canteen at Oak Park Heights. We've got offenders that work in food service at Oak Park Heights and do some cleaning jobs in the living units and the hallways. Though, unlike other facilities, we don't allow offenders at Oak Park Heights to work in building maintenance kind of jobs where they might be able to compromise the security of the facility by learning the facility's maintenance systems or security systems. So in a nutshell, that's what's different about Oak Park Heights, and that's why other people are coming to us wondering, how do we do it?
Thank you.
And hopefully we'll tour of at least one of these facilities. In the past, we've toured, I think we went to Stillwater and Red Wing. We went to Oak Park Heights, and that kind of creepy out. It's, that facility there, it's got some real hard cases in it, and some of the segregation, you look up and you realize they're in there most of the day and pacing back and forth and staring it out. It gives you a real feeling for what it must be like in there. So. Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, we would welcome you and the committee to come and tour the facilities. Stillwater and Oak Park Heights being about 1,000 yards apart as the crow flies is a pretty easy twofer. And we would even offer the prison transport bus to move the committee around in style and comfort.
Sounds fun. I think we took that once before, the prison bus and the little cages. We weren't shackled up, but
Chairman,
some of us should have been. No, anybody else here?
Grunhagen just wanted to be shackled up. I just wanted to share that.
Okay, Commissioner, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, did I answer your questions about St. Cloud?
Yes. Yeah. The reason I was wondering is some of the staff know it already, but my grandpa made a tour through there. He went first to St. Cloud, and then he was sent to Stillwater for part of his life, and I would just kind of wonder why they sent him to St. Cloud first. I noticed that in his prison diary, and it must have been they just take him there and then they farm him out to other places. So. All right, thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Can
I just ask a question dealing with St. Cloud?
What's that?
Can I ask a question dealing with St. Cloud?
Yes, go ahead, Reverend.
We're on that subject. I did have a chance to tour there some time ago with a committee, and I don't remember which committee, but I was there officially with some other folks. I remember having a barber training program as one of the things that we saw. Are those kind of activities still functioning? This was at St. Cloud, because one of our members volunteered to have his hair cut, and I thought that was quite interesting, and he got a shave. So I just wondered if those kind of programs are still functioning, and that's an area that's kind of a lost art. So it's a good thing if you're still doing it, because we need barbers. So,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nornes, I'm not completely sure off the top of my head about St. Cloud, because there was an impending retirement there, so I can't say for sure that barbering program is operating, but we do have another one at Moose Lake.
Hopefully okay. Clippers are not straight edges.
Oh, they had a straight edge.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick reference to that. I know St. Cloud had that bricklayer program. At one time, the recidivism rate was under 3%. Is it still that great, or has it gone up?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, we still do have the masonry program at St. Cloud. I can't quote recidivism rates from that program, but it's still there.
It just gives a good old war story here. When I mentioned my grandpa, the way it used to be, my grandpa had an alcohol problem, and he contracted this job. He was an interior and exterior decorator, a real good one, and he collected $47.50 from a local person. He was supposed to go out and buy paint, and spent it on alcohol and went on a binge, and he was brought into court and given a year to pay it back, and he didn't, and so after the year they brought him back and sent him to Stillwater for a couple of years for $47.50. So that's what was called fraud. That's how it was in the old days. Now I think the limit is quite a bit up, and you have to really work to get there. But it's funny it wasn't overcrowded in those days.
Mr. Chairman, let me talk about Stillwater for a minute. We've got 1,600 offenders at Stillwater now. That facility was built in 1914 and replaced the territorial prison. It's level four close custody. There's about 100 of those 1,600 fellas live outside the wall at the minimum security facility at Stillwater. Stillwater houses about half of our prison industry's program's manufacturing capacity. Rush City opened in the year 2000 with 987 adult offenders. Everyone at Rush City is double bunked except offenders in the disciplinary segregation unit. It's a level four close custody facility. MinCor also operates the license tag plant there at Rush City now, and they do plastics at Rush City and some wood products in that facility as well. We've got a CD treatment program there for sex offenders who are destined for longer stints in sex offender treatment. But what we've found is if you mix the sex offenders in with other chemically dependent offenders, they really don't disclose the things they ought to about their criminal past because of the stigma of that. So running a CD program just for sex offenders cuts to the quick a lot sooner than running them through other programs. So it's a pretty specialized spot. Lino Lakes houses almost 1,300 offenders. It's a level three medium custody facility. It also houses 168 beds for the Interchange Freedom Initiative, which is a faith-based reentry program that is funded and run by Prison Fellowship. There's about 300 chemical dependency beds at Lino Lakes and about 200 sex offender beds at Lino Lakes. The Faribault facility is now our largest facility. Members that have been around for a while remember that we've put a lot of bonding dollars into Faribault in the last few years. We've essentially doubled the size of that facility to 2,000 offenders. It was an old state hospital facility. It opened at a prison in 1989. It's level three medium custody. We have a geriatric unit there for offenders that are above the age of 55 and have significant medical needs. It's now our largest facility, and the last bonding phase that we've got the intake and receiving unit is scheduled to be completed and opened this summer. Willow River Moose Lake, it has two sites. At the Moose Lake site, they house about 1,000 offenders. Level three medium custody. MinCor operates a large factory operation there with printing and clothing. They make everything from T-shirts and briefs for our prison population to, I think, blankets and sheets at that facility. At the Willow River site, we house our challenge incarceration program for 178 offenders. Challenge incarceration is more colloquially known as a boot camp. We bring military bearing and discipline to those offenders in that facility, but we also offer chemical dependency treatment and education at that facility. It was opened in 1992. It's minimum security, and the offenders that go there are a carefully selected group of usually drug and property offenders. used to be that we had a lot of meth offenders there, and a few DWI offenders, but that seems to be just shifting the opposite. More DWI offenders now, as laws that have been passed in recent years have dropped the number of meth offenders coming to prisons by controlling the ingredients to manufacture methamphetamine. The Shakopee facility is our only facility for females in the state. There's 565 female offenders there. It opened in 1986 at this site. The original site was across the street. It houses all security levels from level 1 to level 5, including 95 women who are incarcerated for some degree of murder. There is also an IFI program at Shakopee.
Before we get to a question from Representative Mullery, Mr. Carter, would you give just a little bit of history on the fence issue at Shakopee?
Mr. Chair, this has been an issue that's been around for a couple years. I think it even made YouTube, wasn't it? Or with the Comedy Channel. But it's, you know, should they put a fence around Shakopee, it's fairly, you know, it's in a community, and that was the big debate. Should there be a fence put around it? They had a couple bonding requests in there, and I don't know the current status of that. Maybe the commissioner can comment on that.
Commissioner, is there still a request out there?
Mr. Chairman, members, the fence at Shakopee did not make the governor's bonding list the last time we did capital investment. We still have not determined what will be in Governor Dayton's bonding list, and so that's the status right now.
So far we haven't had any major incidents, it seems like, but it's kind of funny when you're taking a tour of the place, people are walking around, it looks more like a daycare center and a college than it does if you've got walkways, people walking around and no fence. And anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there. And Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now that we've had more years on the boot camp, what are the recidivism rates from that compared to roughly identical prisoners that don't go through the boot camp?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, we did a study on the boot camp results and published it a couple of years ago. And it was successful both in reducing recidivism and in saving prison bed days. At the time, under the admission criteria that were in place at the time, we can get the committee reference to that report that's on the DOC website. The criteria changed in the last year or so, and so it making it easier for some offenders to get into the program. And so we're currently conducting a study to see whether or not the change in the criteria has made a difference in recidivism. We don't have the results of that yet.
Just a follow-up, thank you. And is there a difference in the cost of that compared to the other, if they're in the regular program?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, I believe there is a difference in cost, but I don't recall what it is right now, and I don't have that information with me. We'll get that for you.
Thank you.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chris, what is that the capacity of the Willow River, the 178, and what's the average stay of an individual there, length of stay?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, there are 180 beds in the challenge incarceration program up there, and the average is 178. We keep it as full as we can keep it. The challenge incarceration program has three phases. The first phase is 6 months at the Willow River facility. Everybody does a minimum of 6 months, and if an offender was having a little problem, if he was having a difficulty with the military bearing or discipline or with the rules there, we might extend them a couple of weeks or maybe a month, give them a chance to succeed in that program, but basically nobody goes much beyond that. The next two phases in the program are in the community under supervised release. There's a phase two is 6 months under intensive supervised release, and then phase three is under regular release until their expiration date.
We'll have Representative Johnson, and then we better speed her up a little bit because we've got to get the post board up, and we've got quite a few pages left to go. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Chris, could you give me the, not today, but when you go back to office, what the inmate-to-staff ratio is at the different facilities, and not including administrative staff and library staff and cooking staff and so forth, but specifically the line staff, the inmate ratio?
Yes. Mr. Chair, yes, we can do that.
Okay, thank you. All right, Commissioner, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, moving quickly, one of our two juvenile facilities is at Red Wing. We've got 111 offenders there. This is another old facility opened in 1889. We also house about 42 adult offenders in a minimum security unit in that facility. Our Togo facility houses 20 to 25 at-risk youth. This is a fee-for-service program for the juveniles in that facility, and we also have our CIP site for women in that facility. We've got significant challenges mentioning some of these older facilities and maintaining them. As Commissioner Bray said, we've got 6 million interior square feet to maintain in our department. That's the largest of any state department, not counting the universities and the colleges. And we've got lots of roofs that need to be repaired, lots of safety issues that we've got to address when you've got that much square feet. Population projections are something that we always try to keep on top of. While the population has risen 54% in the last 10 years, over the last 5 years, in 5 years going into the future, we predict a fairly flat population projection. The upshot of that is that we're probably not going to be back here asking you for more prison beds in the foreseeable future. We might have to talk about beds for females in the 2014 session because that population is growing at a little bit faster rate than adult males. Our bed space plan is to put offenders in county jails after we fill up our beds, and we'll start filling up our beds again around 2013. We want to put about 300 offenders in county jails, and then we're hoping that the private prison in Appleton, Minnesota, Prairie Correctional, would be available to us for as many as 1,600 offenders in that facility. Who's in prison? Convicted felony offenders. You don't go to prison in Minnesota unless you get sentenced to more than a year. Our offenders have an average of 7 convictions, 3 of those being felonies. Our inmate profile shows that 51% of the people in prison are personal offenders, and to break that down a little bit more, about 17% of everybody in prison is a sex offender, 14% have committed some degree of homicide, and 12% have committed some level of assault. One of the cost drivers that Mr. Carger mentioned and is a concern for us is health care. One case of congestive heart failure can cost us $344,000 to treat. On the other hand, we save a bunch of money on dialysis now by putting a dialysis unit in the prison at Oak Park Heights so that we don't have to take offenders out into the community for their dialysis. We've got about 10 or 12 dialysis patients at that facility now. We've got
just curious, what happens to somebody in these prisons when they expire? What's the death rate like about per year? And what happens to them after they do? Do they return to the family? And if they aren't, where do they go?
Mr. Chairman, members, when offenders are reaching the end of life, and we've got Several a year, I would say maybe 10 or 12 a year that might have cancer, heart failure, things like that. First, we do operate a hospice at Oak Park Heights for those offenders. We do planning with them in terms of living wills and do not resuscitate, do not intubate sorts of things, just like would happen in a community. And when they do pass away, their remains and their property is turned over to the families. There's a small stipend that the state pays toward funeral expenses for those offenders every year. And if the family doesn't claim them, then we rotate among funeral homes in the Stillwater area, and they take care of the arrangements.
They are given a certain amount of dignity in their end and proper burial. And
absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Slocum and then Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm reading the last bullet, which says 22% of adult males are on psychotropic medications and 68% of adult females are on psychotropic. Can you elaborate a little bit as to why there's that huge percentage difference?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slocum, there's a couple of theories we operate on there. One is that there's many, many more males incarcerated in Minnesota than there are females. And so the females that come to prison in Minnesota really seem to get into a lot more trouble before and have a lot more personal troubles before they get into prison in Minnesota. So that's one factor. We also find that females seem to be more willing to ask for help when they need it. And so those are the two factors that we see and that account for that disparity in the rate of psychotropic medications.
Any follow-up? Okay, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I remember when we had a prison subcommittee, and at that time, before Faribault was redone, they had the really bad health ones. And there were a number of them that were in such bad shape that they couldn't even feed themselves, so we had to have people feeding them. And yet they told us because of the determinant sentencing at that point, this is many years ago, there wasn't a way to get them out. They were obviously not a threat to society and the astronomical cost to us. Is there a way to get them out now so we're not paying this cost, or has that changed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, there is a conditional medical release so that we can find a suitable nursing home placement for these offenders when we are sure that they are no longer a risk to the public or a risk to the other nursing home residents.
Thank you.
Fun facts and figures here. The this was kind of what I was getting at when I was asking the question about recidivism. At 50% of property offenders released in 06 were convicted of a felony-level crime within 3 years of the original release. 42% of those originally convicted of an offense categorized as other were reconvicted within 3 years of the release. Over one-third of person and other drug non-methamphetamine offenders were reconvicted within 3 years of release. Property offenders also are most likely to be returned to prison as either a new court commitment or a release return with a new sentence. Just some things to file in the back of your head. I find those statistics kind of interesting. Thank you. And Commissioner, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, we offer treatment, chemical dependency, sex offender, mental health treatment, medical treatment, and combination. We've got about 1,800 offenders that have been assessed as needing sex offender treatment and 350 beds for that. About 2,900 offenders assessed in need for chemical dependency treatment and about 804 beds assessed for that. So we've got a challenge finding enough beds to treat these offenders. The good news is that we've got studies that show that treatment for sex offender and chemical dependency does reduce recidivism. Those studies are available on our website. We also do educational programming in all of our facilities. 32% of our offenders come to us without a high school diploma or a GED. We graduated about 534 offenders last year with those degrees. We operate a number of inmate work assignments in prison industries, facility maintenance, and food service, and the community work crews that Commissioner Bray discussed earlier. From that inmate employment, we are able to get from inmates $380,000 a year in court ordered restitution, $247,000 a year in dependent support, and $269,000 a year in aid to victims of crime.
Commissioner, let's jump in with a couple of questions. Representative McDonald and then Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Commissioner, yesterday's committee meeting for the Human Health Services Finance, we got the numbers that were pertinent to the Moose Lake and the St. Peter's sex offender program, so I'm just curious how the per diem compares with your program of the 1,800 sex offenders at your facilities.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, we don't sort out the sex offenders in our facilities for a separate per diem. They are under the $83.95 per diem that we spoke of earlier.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Commissioner, do you have a success rate, or is there any way to gauge the success of your rehabilitation of those offenders?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, I was moving quickly, and so I went by that statistic, but we do have a study that is on the website with a lot more information, but one statistic is that after treatment, we reduce the risk of rearrest for a sex offense by 27%.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And this is going to be important for the next committee as well in determining the their budget. If you're able to do it for $83.95 per diem per day, and the Department of Health and Human Services, the programs in Moose Lake and St. Peter does it for $328, I'd like to know your successes, and perhaps your successes can be shared in that department, therefore saving taxpayers in Minnesota, I think, a lot of money. So I think those two are very germane, and I hope that we can study those, and certainly, is it level 1, 2, and 3, or all individually or together?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, these are all sex offenders in the Department of Corrections, regardless of their level.
Mr. Chair?
Representative McDonald.
Then how do we kind of have the two look at the numbers and find out what their success rate is, so it's not just dialogue here, but put into action? Is there a process?
Let Mr. Carger and maybe Mr. Diebel to explain the clarification on that.
Mr. Chair and members, on the per diem rate, now here's a difference, because when the sex offender program, when they calculate their per diem rate, they also include bonding and administrative expenses. So to be comparable with that, and the commissioner may correct me if I'm wrong, I think you would have to use the rate of $103.09 to equally compare to the sex offender program.
Yes, that's fine.
Right. And then I think one of the reasons, too, as was discussed before, is that the sex offender program involves much more treatment. You know, so it's not a prison setting, and maybe Mr. Diebel can give a little more on that.
Mr. Diebel?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members, the sex offender program that's operated by the Health and Human Services or with oversight there, they have the expense of treating their clients, as or however you want to refer to them, patients, as not as incarcerated individuals with a lack of rights and they've lost their freedom for doing something wrong. They've lost their freedom because we've deemed them dangerous to the rest of us and they're a threat. And so our job there is to make them better. That's the operating principle. And so they have to bring in highly qualified staff to treat these offenders, whether they want to be treated or not. and that drives up the cost. And also, you can't keep them in the same type of restricted environment that they do in the DOC. So again, you've got a different level. The concern is that if you push the sex offender program too far towards a prison, it'll no longer be deemed an acceptable use of civil commitment. It'll be deemed a prison. And that's where no one knows where that boundary is. That would be decided by the courts. But the risk is that if you push it too far towards a prison setting, the court would say you're no longer treating these individuals as patients. You're not providing them with the services that you need to help them get better, and therefore it's unconstitutional. And if in that case, the state would be in a hard spot, because you can't, if they were ordered released, you can't put them in prison because they don't have any criminal sanctions hanging over their head. So that's the dilemma that the policymakers have to fight with or to resolve, is where do you find the ground where the courts won't deem this as incarceration, but will deem them be receiving the treatment they are expected to receive as civilly committed patients.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll continue to explore this offline, but I appreciate the clarification and the information.
Representative Woodard.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to report that that's exactly the conversation I wanted to have, so I no longer have a question.
And Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Crist, are there any offenders that are committed to the sex offender program, civilly committed, that have not gone through a sex offender treatment program and corrections?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, there may be. The sex offender programs that we operate in the Department of Corrections are essentially voluntary, to the extent that an offender has to, if they're in the program, they've got to participate. They've got to disclose their past crimes. They've got to be willing to discuss and do assignments and things like that. And if they are unwilling to do that, it would be a waste of our time to try to jam treatment down their throats. And so there are occasionally offenders that do go through the commitment process and do go to the sex offender program at MSOP under DHS without having had treatment in the Department of Corrections.
So, Representative Hilton. Mr. Chair, Commissioner, would it be fair to say then that the people that end up being civilly committed are either ones that have been deemed not successfully to have completed the treatment program, or have refused to participate in a treatment program and correction?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, those two groups do have people that wind up getting committed, but there's also a group of offenders who do go through the Department of Corrections treatment programs, and we would say participate successfully, but still wind up being civilly committed. What happens in the civil commitment process through the courts doesn't always rely on what happens in corrections, whether or not they're going to commit them or not. And some of those guys might not need to be committed by some standard, and some of those fellas are, even though they participate well, might reach that threshold of dangerousness and ought to be committed anyway.
Thank you.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Crist, when you were talking about chemical dependency services, does the department use typical Minnesota model, or are you doing cognitive behavioral therapy or combination? And if you've changed the model, is there better success?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we did what's been referred to as the Minnesota model for a long, long time. I think we're now moving more into cognitive therapy. And the studies that we have show that recidivism in that group is reduced by 30%.
That's great. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Bray talked a lot about the reentry programming that we do. In the interest of time, I'll just skip over these two slides and note that we reentry starts as soon as somebody comes to prison. We work on it from the day they get there until the day they're released, and then the transition to the agents out into the community. And with that, I would turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Lisa Ogrosky to discuss the Operations Support Services Units.
Thank you, Commissioner Christ. And Commissioner Ogrosky, go ahead.
Good morning. They say they save the best for last, so that's why Operations Support is last. I will go over these slides rather quickly, but the Operations Support Unit, I believe, is the one that is the glue that holds the agency together. It's the support services like finance, human resources, policy and legal, and information technology. We also have in there employee development and victim assistance and restorative justice. And of course, these are the units that do the budget preparation, they do fiscal notes, they do our hiring, our recruitment, they run our academies, they do victim notification, they do our sentence administration and our litigation management. One of our biggest challenges right now is being able to maintain service not only to our own agency, but also to some community and county organizations. We provide finance and human resources also for Sentencing Guidelines Commission. We have, over the last 10 years, worked very hard at regionalizing some of our services. We used to have finance staff in every single prison, but now we have finance staff maybe for two prisons or three prisons all in one area. We've also centralized certain activities, some at our central office, but sometimes it's at the prison. An example of that is any money order coming into offender, into any offender in our whole entire system, is sent to Moose Lake, and it is processed by one facility, and they're specialized in that area. I want to just give a couple examples of some work that our IT unit does that helps out the public. This is just a snapshot of our offender locator, which is on our public website. So anyone can go in and find where any offender is and which facility they're in. It also provides some public data on what their sentence or their crime was. Next is our Level 3 sex offender website. This actually gets a lot of hits. So people can go in and you can put your five digits of code in, and it'll tell you what offenders are in your area. This is our fugitive website. If anybody ever sees any of these guys, please call the number. Our OSI, Office of Special Investigation Unit, uses this website to show outstanding fugitives. This is a law enforcement viewer, provides information to local law enforcement and state patrol, sheriffs, county deputies. Our statewide supervision system is used by all three delivery systems to help monitor probation and supervise release of our offenders. This is a sentencing guidelines worksheet. It's used by the courts and probation so they can try to figure out what the sentencing guidelines are for certain crimes. And this is a risk assessment tool used by probation agents, and it's a validated risk assessment tool, and you've heard a little bit about that throughout the day. I do want to talk a little bit about some of the budget reductions we've taken in the past. I want to be very clear about this. These are very specific programmatic or operational changes. During the same time frame, however, we have received funding because we've had additional offenders in our prisons. So what this means is our budget has remained relatively flat, probably for the past 10 years. We have, back in 2000, we made a conscious effort to look at our per diem and to look at ways that we could reduce our per diem. At that time, over 200 positions were eliminated. It was through a five-year plan. So it started in 2002, and money was cut out of our budgets for that. We also did some additional double bunking at the St. Cloud and Stillwater facilities during the 2004-05 biennium, where the state was also in a significant budget crisis, in order to help save funding. We eliminated 80 positions also at that time. Throughout the next couple bienniums, there were some cuts made. That 06-07 biennium, there were savings due to some conditional release options that were thrown out there. And we had more double bunking. And then there was also a bill passed that mentally ill offenders could be released to certain housing.
Commissioner, when you say you eliminated an X number of positions, is that have you ever gotten into layoffs yet, or has it been attrition?
Mr. Chair, we have laid people off. It's been a minimal number because most of the things we have done we have planned for, and so we try to do it through attrition. I believe in the 04-05 session, we probably had maybe 8-10 layoffs, and during the last biennium, I believe we had maybe 7 or 8.
Oh, did that use the term hard and soft layoff here? A real layoff where they lose the job, or is it a bump off into another classification where they still retain a job?
Mr. Chair, when I talk about the layoff, that's the end result of somebody walking out the door. The original person who got laid off very likely may or may not have bumped down, but those are the numbers of people who walked out the door. You know, we're fortunate that we have a relatively large agency, and sometimes people who maybe were in a support position might try to be a correctional officer. And, you know, where the vacancy is sometimes isn't necessarily where the job is needed or where you're having to lay off. So we've been fortunate that way.
Okay, go ahead.
We have some unique budget challenges in our agency, and we don't have any way to control admissions. You know, the courts send somebody to prison, and they show up at the door, and we have to take them. And so that's a unique challenge for us. We are largely state-funded. You know, we are a core government service. Public safety is a core government service. And I would say between 95% and 97% of our budget is state dollars. And we have very few mechanisms to charge fees. We're not talking about a population that has money that can pay for services. We do charge a 10% cost of confinement on any money sent in, which goes back to buying mattresses, linens, clothes for the offenders. We also charge a health care copayment of $3. So every time an inmate wants to go see medical services, we do charge them $3. But these are not people who have money, so that really limits our ability to try to recuperate any funds. With that, if there's any other questions.
Questions from any members? Either one of you want to take a guess who the new commissioner of corrections is going to be?
Mr. Chairman,
you better not
a chance.
I was going to say, can you tell us?
Mr. Chairman, I did want to make one addition to what Ms. Ogrosky said. The Office of Special Investigations operates a fugitive apprehension unit for those offenders who abscond from supervised release. The fugitives that they catch are people that are out on parole and didn't want to leave the impression with the committee that they were escapees or any other kind of fugitive. They caught well over 400 fugitives last year with our 6 or 7 person unit.
Is Commander Gerlach still? Is that how you pronounce her name?
Mr. Chair, Carrie Gerlacher is the director of OSI and of the unit.
Don't tell her I mispronounced her name. All right. Any questions from members for anybody from Corrections? Corrections, as they know, are a huge piece of the pie, and they suffer kind of the same fate sometimes as human services being such a large part of the budget. That's where people go for money, and so naturally their N10 are up wondering, you know, what's going to happen to them this session. Yeah, question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, just back to that health care. Do you pay those health care costs? Do you right out of your budget directly? Because obviously they don't have health insurance, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we budget about $35 million a year for health care costs. We contract with a private company that manages our health care as to utilization review and prescription formularies.
Okay.
They contract with the health providers around the state so that we do one contract for our healthcare business when 10, 15 years ago, we probably had 115 contracts that we were doing ourselves, and now we do one contract. And we think that they've done a great job for us. They've helped us probably avoid millions of dollars of costs in the years since we've had that healthcare model.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Commissioners. I appreciate the information. Good to see you again. Are you ready, Director Melton? I've been just waiting to get this guy in the hot seat. What's this? Good morning, Director Melton. And if you want to give your name and title, and go ahead with your presentation.
Chair Cornish, members of the committee, my name is Neil Melton. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officers Standards and Training, more commonly known as POST. POST is much smaller than the Department of Corrections. I'll move a lot quicker, I believe. You should have, I understand, a copy of the agency profile in your materials, and I'll refer to that time to time, but I think agency overview presentations primarily deal with what agencies do and how much it costs. I think it'd be valuable, especially for the new members, to hear a brief summary of why the POST Board exists, how we came into being, because historical perspectives are often key to understanding current conditions. The POST Board was created by legislation 34 years ago. Minnesota was the first state in the nation to depart from the traditional paramilitary police academies and go to a college-based degree program. I'm proud to say that we still serve as an example to the nation when it comes to law enforcement training and education. As part of the enabling legislation 34 years ago, the legislature crafted our mission statement, and what it said is to enhance the profession of law enforcement in Minnesota through the selection, education, licensing, and regulations of peace officers. This is no small task, considering there are 458 agencies in Minnesota, state, county, and local, that's as of this morning, and 10,500 officers. One rationale behind the POST Board concept is that the state has a vested interest in guaranteeing law enforcement is professional and consistent across the state, from Ada to Zumbrota, from agencies that are large and small, rural, suburban, those with resources, and those agencies without. All citizens, regardless of where they live, deserve the best public safety services we can provide. One of my standard lines in speech is that in Minnesota, law enforcement begins in a college classroom. All of our officers have a minimum of 2-year degree. I'm guessing roughly 20% have a 4-year degree. And it's not uncommon to have people out on the patrol cars with graduate degrees in criminal justice, law degrees, and there are even a handful of doctoral degrees doing peace officer duties in Minnesota. Over 30 years, we've been doing this, and we've produced some of the best educated and most professional officers in the country. And that's evidenced by the number of agencies from other states who come here on a routine basis to recruit our candidates fresh out of college or to try to steal our officers off the street and take them to their schools. As a licensing and regulatory board, POST performs a unique public service. One of the basic functions of state government is to regulate the practices of various professions, medicine, law, education, barbers, cosmetologists, you name it. The goal of regulation is to improve health and the safety of all our citizens. We have two roles. We regulate and we're a resource. Now, the regulatory component is rather straightforward. It's defined in statute and rule, and we just follow those directives. But a bigger portion of what we do is serve as a resource, not only to law enforcement, but to the legislature, elected officials all across the state, colleges, special interest groups, you name it. We're a resource, and that requires a lot more critical thinking, problem solving, and creative thought. To accomplish that goal, POST regularly meets with our primary stakeholders. And they talk about police chiefs, sheriffs, line officers, educators, legislators, local officials, special interest groups, and citizens in the governor's office. We meet with those people on a routine basis to discuss current issues in law enforcement. And hardly a day goes by that one of the headlines in the newspaper doesn't have something to do with law enforcement or public safety. In your packet is the profile that includes a list of POST strategies. What I'd like to do is focus on the verbs, because they best explain what POST Board does. We administer licensing exams. Those are regular exams, interstate reciprocity, as well as military reciprocity. And in the final the last category of military, POST has been a partner in the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon initiatives for years, and hoping to assist veterans who want to become peace officers. We license peace officers and part-time officers. We renew and restore licenses. We manage a training reimbursement fund. I'll get to that more in detail later. We monitor compliance of standards of conduct. We conduct random on-site compliance reviews at law enforcement agencies. We go out and visit chiefs, sheriffs, or the state agencies to look at policies and training, make sure they're in compliance. We work with the colleges, 24 of them, to establish pre-service education curriculum. We sit down and try to figure out what it is peace officers need to know to be effective in their jobs. And we monitor compliance with continuing education, because in Minnesota, every peace officer must maintain a certain number of continuing education hours per year in order to maintain that license. And in addition to the list, we were coerced into becoming the repository in Minnesota for a national law that allows former peace officers to carry firearms nationally. And actually, there is a POST board, 15 members. They're appointed by the governor to four-year staggered terms, and collectively, they are my boss. I want to read the list because it's rather unique. It's defined in statute. One of the members is the superintendent of the BCA. We have two police chiefs, two sheriffs, four officers, one of whom must be a trooper. We've got two former officers who now work as faculty members in the college system. We have one administrator from the college system, two public members that have no identifiable connection with law enforcement one way or the other, and lastly, a very specific category, my favorite. One elected official from a community outside the metro area with a population less than 5,000. That's stated in statute. Currently the mayor from Browns Valley. Post-staffing, we currently have 11 full-time equivalent employees, 6 MAPE professional positions, 3 AFSCME administrative support positions, 1 middle management office services position, and 1 executive position, that would be me. And to be sure, POST has felt the economic pain over the years. Staffing has been reduced from 15 FTEs in 2001, so we've had a 20% staff reduction in 10 years. Stakeholders. I mentioned we have 458 agencies in the state, large and small, all of them. We have 349 local police departments, 87 sheriffs, 8 non-municipal police departments, that's like Metro Transit and the airport and the state fair and some of those unique police departments. The University of Minnesota has 3. We have 8 tribal PDs, and we have 6 state law enforcement agencies. State Patrol, BCA, etc. Agencies range from 1 officer to 800. 10% of the agencies in Minnesota have 1 officer. 1 officer. 40% have 7 or fewer. Now, 7's a critical number because that's the number of employees you need to provide 24-hour coverage 7 days a week. 7 employees provide 24/7 coverage. Only 15 agencies in Minnesota, 15 of the 458, have over 100. So as you can see, policing in Minnesota is a local concept. It is kept in small groups. But that's changing. Since 1990, over 110 agencies in Minnesota have either consolidated services with another agency, they've contracted with another agency to cover their police service, or they've simply disbanded. They've gone out of business and sort of turned it over to the county sheriff's office to handle law enforcement. That transition from local policing to regional or with the county is a fascinating study, and we've been monitoring that very, very closely for years, and it follows the pattern of many years ago about regional education, regional hospitals, regional public services. It's just a natural progression. And we're trying to stay on top of that to help the agencies and the communities that are struggling with that. I get calls from local elected officials asking, what should we do? And I tell them, I don't have that answer. But what I can do is give you a list of questions to ask. And once you complete those questions, the answer should be clear. When I talk budgets, I always bring back. Behind me is Dan Boydham from the Department of Public Safety. He serves as our executive budget officer. He's here and he's eager to answer questions about the numbers. But in a nutshell, the Post Board is funded through a special revenue account from a surcharge on certain criminal and traffic convictions. There are no direct tax dollars. About the surcharge. The original surcharge was created in 1998, and it was $25, added on top of whatever fines that an offender may pay. $25. Now the surcharge is 70 cents. Post still gets a portion of the original first 25. The special revenue account that funds the Post generates about $14 million a year. It is distributed by statute as follows. Of the $14 million, 1% automatically goes to the DNR Game and Fish Fund. Post Board is then authorized 39%. That's our ceiling. The remaining 60%, and whatever is left over by not achieving the ceiling for Post, is transferred to the general fund. So the actual budget for Post is set by you. Currently, the Post Board budget is not the 39% authorized maximum, but is closer to 23%. Of what Post does receive, approximately 75% of that money is returned to local units of government in the form of training reimbursements to help offset police training costs. The legislature has directed two mandates for training. One is use of force annually, from firearms to handcuffing to searching to tasers, anything that has to be done annually, and that's expensive for every officer. And the legislature also mandated use of or pursuit driving or emergency vehicle operations once every 48 months, and that's expensive. So we take that training money, send it back to the states, and a per-officer share to help offset some of those costs. Now, unfortunately, the per-officer reimbursement share has decreased since 2003, and it's been reduced by 24% since 1989. That was 22 years ago. Certainly, costs go up, but the training's gone down. But I have to give credit to law enforcement agencies across the state. They are doing a yeoman's job of trying to merge training, cooperate, partner, finding new ways to deliver training to keep our officers on the cutting edge and also protecting our citizens. They spend an inordinate amount of time talking about how to best deliver training in Minnesota. The Post Board budget for FY11 is $4.5 million. $1.1 is the general operating budget, salaries, rents, phones, etc. $3.4, I said, goes to the training reimbursement. So, Mr. Chair, that is the abbreviated version of the Post Board. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Director Melton. The now you see what I referred to the other day, like the fire safety account. They also have an account that we're sealing. We really should be given, but we haven't. And one question was, what has there anything you haven't been able to do because of the FTEs or a mission that you would like to accomplish that you haven't, or how has it affected you with the loss in staff?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the one that stands out is what we used to do, and that was track credits of all the officers in the state to ensure that they were meeting the continuing education and in the specific areas of use of force and vehicle pursuits. We no longer do that. That staff position left. Now we rely on sort of an honor system that when the officers come time to renew, we select a random number of those licensees and we send them a letter and telling them to affirm by sending us the documents. We show us the credentialing that you had, certificates you received, show us your training. A second thing is recruitment. We used to have a recruitment position and we'd go around the state, various communities, colleges, school groups, churches, if we could get three people to stand still long enough, we'd talk to them about becoming peace officers. And the idea was to expand diversity in law enforcement. That position, the recruitment was lost, and we partner now with agencies that do their own recruiting, because agencies are so unique. Someone recruiting to the State Patrol is not going to be recruiting the same person that they may in Thief River Falls and vice versa. So we've had to cut down on a number of our mission.
Okay, we're pushing to noon hour. Any questions from members? Thank you, Director. Appreciate it. Oh, how many, what, is there a position open on the board now to fill?
Yes, we have a sheriff's position that is due to be filled. We will have a police chief's position that's due to be filled, soon to be Commissioner Mona Doma. And we have one officer position.
I have heard rumors of some people definitely wanting to put more street cops on and less top heavy, but we'll be talking about that through channels.
They're my boss, Mr. Chair, and I love them all.
All right. Take care. Thank you very much for your testimony. And with that, members, our next meeting is tomorrow, same time, same place. And I think Representative Kriesel will be up with his bill tomorrow, right? All right. Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.